Welcome back to Into the Open. This episode is titled Sharing is Caring. Why? Because when I first virtually met our guest, Alan Levine, he was proudly wearing a Sharing is Caring t-shirt. Alan has been involved and influential in the open community for what seems to be eons now. Not to age him, he doesn't like that very much. Almost everybody that I've had a chance to talk to in the open community at some point has brought up Alan's name and how he's positively influenced them in their journey into the open. Through creating, collaborating, commenting on other people's blogs, Alan truly has helped the open community and open education grow. So come join me as I pick Alan's brain about what it means to share and get to meet his dog, Felix, too. I was wondering if you could tell me how you first got involved in open education or stumbled into it.
Well, thank you, Nicole. And now I feel like I'm going to be like old person stories where it's like back when we, you know, would walk through the snow to get to the podcast shack or something like that. But I guess it was before there's probably even like a name or an idea for it. So when I started my career, I was doing what would now be called instructional technology with Maricopa Community College System in Phoenix. How they hired me on a lark because I really didn't have, I had a little bit of teaching, I had a little bit of programming, I had a little bit of everything. But back then, and I'm going to date myself and be like, then you'll say like, that was before I was born probably, or 1992, 93. And I was just trying to look for interesting uses of technology. And there wasn't internet then. And so I was then like looking at and doing some prototypes and programming in HyperCard, which is kind of like in many ways the predecessor to multimedia and the idea of hyperlinked, et cetera. And what I found was a great place to learn was this FTP site from Stanford called the Sumex AIM Archives. It was like the name of the computer. But what it's really simple. What happened was people who they shared lots of things like little utilities and programs that sometimes were created, but also people who were interested in things like HyperCard or other things would upload and share the things that they had created or things that they wanted help with. And so it was there for me to sort of download and open up, and it was open for me to sort of inspect and learn from. And so it just became almost reflexive to say like, someone shared this with me, like anything I create, I'm going to share back with other people because like I'm getting paid a salary to do my other work. And so this is not a monetary thing. And just what I found was in sort of connecting with other people doing similar work, then through email listservs, et cetera, is that all of a sudden you got this like affinity with someone. You know, I had a friend, Darcy Norman, who's at University of Calgary now. And so like he was doing the same kind of work I was, almost in isolation in his institution, because there weren't many of us. And sort of you started getting this sense of asking questions, being willing to share, and people willing to give it back. So it just sort of became ingrained in me, like, if I create anything, why not share it in case someone else finds it useful? And sort of give up the idea of ownership. And this was, you know, predated, you know, some of the ideas that came along towards the end of that decade, you know, with David Wiley working on some of the first open licenses and Creative Commons. But it just sort of seemed more like that natural, like it seems almost simplistic to say, like you remember as a kid, like you had something and you shared it with other kids. And that's way simplified, but it was really that beginning and the idea that I could learn from other people because they shared stuff that wasn't finished or wasn't polished with me.
Right. You were able to almost innovate and combine ideas. It was more of a collaboration than versus I'm just giving and taking.
And of course, like now, like in the beginning, you're like, oh my God, there's all these people who know way more than me.
Yeah.
I'm just going to be quiet and listen. I don't have anything to contribute. And then as you learn to be more proficient at something, whether it's music or media or programming or speaking a language, I guess you start to feel like, wait a minute, I can help someone maybe with an answer to a question, or I can make a suggestion. And sort of you build up this sense that, yeah, I still may downplay and say, oh, my stuff isn't really that great, but I think I have something I can maybe help someone else with.
I think too, for me, what I see is as I move through the process, then I become more confident. in helping others that are maybe starting out on that process. It's like, I've moved through it once, and so these are my mistakes, and so let me fill you in so you don't make those, and then you can kind of have a better start. I don't know if I get confident in being like, yes, I know, I'm an expert, I can share. But
and I found it's not about being an expert, because, you know, I remember like the first time I asked like a question openly on a multimedia listserv, and there was this guy, G. Gordon somebody, from Virginia Tech, who was like, he was very loud, like someone loud in social media. And he basically blasted me, like saying how naive my question was. And it took me like weeks, maybe longer, to sort of lick my chops and go in a little bit more quietly. And so, and that still happens, unfortunately. There are some people, and that's not all people who are experts, but unfortunately, we get locked into this idea that there's sort of these different tiers of people, and some people who have a lot of expertise can be a little bit overly zealous about their expertise.
What I find, and I don't want to date you either, but what I find really interesting is you started this before.
Felix, sorry, come here. He's chasing the cat. You're not cooperating, Felix.
What I was going to say is you predated when you got involved and started. It was before we had all of this advanced technology, really, like the internet and our ability to connect. Like, this is pre-Twitter, social media, So I find it really interesting. It's almost more values-based than that you found this community and you've continued to flourish in it. How do you think our changed, maybe, how we share? Or has it amplified it, or has it altered it in maybe not a good way?
Yes, probably to all. It's a little bit challenging to characterize it. And again, because I'm painted, you know, by my own experiences, and it just was different modality. So then it was, you know, email and news groups, and but it was also more like pockets and like not necessarily completely separate, but there wasn't sort of like the large massive amount of mixing that has both negative and possible consequences that happen now. But, you know, some of the same things can still happen. The greatest thing is that by generally becoming a little bit more participatory, and it's participating is not necessarily being the G. Gordons who speak the loudest. Participating by private messaging and acknowledging people and, you know, writing comments on their blogs and some simpler things that are not like as much big broadcasting and you know, getting attention in social media. And I guess what I found that works is, like, as I connected to some people, I would sort of get to see who they talked with and communicated with. And so there's this like gentle increasing of the number of people that you might be able to bounce off of or just might be interesting to learn about. And so the best part is to me, the most magical things are like accidental serendipity, where you didn't expect to follow someone's Twitter thread and there's a link to something that you'd never seen before. And all of a sudden you've gone down this rabbit hole. And that still happens a lot. For all the problems and the things that people rail against on Twitter, like every day I kind of have that experience. You know, I could name some. I stop marveling at them, but just someone tweeted something referencing this goofy cover song that I did railing at textbook publishers, and someone responded, and I went to check out their site, and way down there I found this link to an Atlas Obscura post about choose your own adventure games, and this company that's still producing them does all these character maps. And like all of a sudden, like, I don't know, 20 minutes have gone. You know, there used to be this site called Stumbled Upon, which was sort of that thing where like people would share these accidental little gems. And so that part of the internet, that's still there in social media. Like often it's like a lot of attention gets paid to things that are loud and trending and sort of things. But to me, the more interesting stuff has always happened in like the smaller crevices, or what they used to call the long tail of the internet, where there's fewer people, but sort of like more odd, curious, random things.
It gets more niche or almost more specific. You can find a little note of interest and follow it. I'm going to share with you, just because I've talked to a couple of people now, and you brought up just participating by even commenting on a blog or doing that. The number of people that have said, oh, I got into Open and then Alan responded to my blog post and blew my mind. So know that, like, Your little responses there have fueled multiple people and have really got them.
Oh, shucks.
An education.
You make me blush, but I used to, it's been a while. I used to try this thing. I think I did it a couple of years. I would take February. I wouldn't write any blog posts. And what I would do is I would spend all my time writing on other people's blogs. And it was inspired because, what's his name? Matthew Kirschenbaum, who's at University of Maryland, who's like kind of like a digital media guru. He wrote on his blog one time about this guy, Francois Lachance, who said he blogged, but he doesn't have a blog. So he called him a comment blogger. So Francois would just basically, he didn't publish in his own space. He would just comment voraciously on other people's blogs. And by the powers of, you know, search engines, he could string together things he'd written elsewhere. And so that always seemed to me interesting. Like someone who's going to, like, instead of claiming the space of their own, they're going to say, like, I'm going to spend my time writing in other people's spaces. And a lot of my interest in commenting, again, was sort of the turnaround. That when, because I got, if I got a comment from someone, I was really motivated to go and write back, especially if it's more than like nice blog post or I like that, when people offer something.
It's a conversation catalyst. It sounds like Francois was a bit of a, he got conversations rolling. And those are important people.
Although I think like last year I was curious and I think he does have a blog now, but I just...
No.
To me, that idea of kind of being like a nomad of sorts. I imagine I'm more like a regal horse galloping around the internet, you know.
Yeah, just
leaving little, you
know, leaving little traces here and there. But it is interesting to talk to other people and how that impacts them. Like, you've definitely had an impact by doing that.
Yeah.
And you don't always see it.
Well, and that's the other thing about sharing, because, you know, when I mean, I think we talked about the stories collection I did.
The stories really inspired this as well. So when we were starting the podcast, Verena was like, no, Alan's project is amazing, the stories project.
And what I would do when I talked about it was like, I can't guarantee that if you share something openly or reach out to someone or do one of these small things that you're going to get one of these, you know, wonderful surprise acts of serendipity in return. I can only guarantee if you never share, it's probably never going to happen to you. It's kind of, you know, I used to try to talk about it like, you know, the potential energy of sharing or something like that, that you just want to create more possibility for serendipity to happen. You know, you can labor on a piece of media, on an audio, on a long blog post, and you can write it and nothing will happen. And then you can dash off something and people will latch onto it. And so you can't really predicate your interest in creativity based upon the response, just that the more you put out there and contribute, the more possibility that something might come back in return, but it might not. And so that can't be the reward. It's got to be like the bonus.
Right. I feel like you said that to me at the beginning of this, like, don't do this for any specific, like, do it if you're interested in it. Do it because you're interested and you want to learn more, and that, like, that you'll put out a good product with, versus trying to connect or forcing it in a way. So it's kind of the same, like, share because you want to share and you're interested and you want to combine ideas and grow.
Yeah. And the process of writing or making the media, it's got to be something you sort of sit down and say, like, this is like, just the act of doing this is kind of feeding myself in a way. It's hard to explain, but, you know, as an example, I just saw my colleague Anne Marie Scott from Athabasca University tweeted out reminding me that it's Ada Lovelace Day. It's second Tuesday of October, recognizing the first person to actually write down a computer program happened to be a woman. And so I had to stop and say, like, what can I do? And so I did a little quick Wikipedia research. I did a little montage collage of two images. For me, doing mashups in Photoshop are kind of like my little bit of relaxation. And so in doing that, you're not only creating, like, yeah, maybe you don't like the media creator, it's no big deal. But I think the act of doing that, I mean, I'm thinking about this person and what she meant and learning about her, and just as you're doing something tangible, whether it's taking out the ums that are going to be in my podcast, you're also like probably thinking about it at a higher level. And so to me, that's the magic of this creative process.
Yeah, I think as long as it's meaningful to you, I have different ways that I create, not Photoshop not being one, but I paint. And so I'm trying to relate what you're saying to painting.
Yeah.
And yeah, maybe it's that process where you For me, I slow down and it causes me to have to think, or it gives me time to think and process and
feel. Felix, sorry, get over here. Get over here. Come on, Felix, get over here. She's taunting him a little bit. But also, there was a post by Dave Cormier about, you know, trying to teach creativity in teachers. And so creativity has a little bit of a laden words because we tend to think of it in the artistic sense. So, you know, when you say painting, it's like, you know, I can barely draw stick figures. I think a lot of times teachers equate creativity with like this artistic kind, or that it's something like super unique and of value. And so I always found in, you know, when I did more direct work with faculty, if they would start out with some disclaimer about like, well, I don't do anything innovative or creative, I would say like, well, just, you know, tell me, you know, what are you teaching right now? And then, and you know, they go through something. Oh yeah. What kind of things are you doing in class? What's your activity? And every time we had this conversation, they would throw out something that to them sounded really small. But there's like, you know, that is really quite, that is innovative. And so people paint down what they do. I do it myself all the time. It's like, I want to keep myself humble. There was this video, the concept that really explained it well by this guy, Derek Sievers, called Ordinary to You, Amazing to Others. And I mean, it was like this little comic illustration, the fact that we dismiss the things that we do as just being ordinary, not special. But if you tell it to someone else, chances are it's going to be meaningful in a way that you don't comprehend. And unfortunately, that tends to block us from even doing the sharing in the first place. Okay, I used to do some things in these and some online presentations about like this subject. And I stole this idea of just putting up a whiteboard slide where people could write. And I would ask them like, what prevents you from sharing what your things that you do or your works? And when people have this chance to anonymously put it down, it's covered. It's to things about like, oh, what I do isn't very creative. It's not innovative. It's not as good as the experts in the field. And so this is the same thing. It stops people from sharing before they even do it, because they just downplay the potential possibility of what they do as being useful or not. And so if you can find that place to kind of do away with the expectation and say like, well, like, you know, when I teach, it's like I kind of tend to make a fool of myself and do goofy things in front of my students, because I don't want them to think, and I don't want me to think I have to be like this master and this perfectionist. Yeah. And so I you know, kind of try to show my humanity. That sounds really cliche, but yeah.
Have you ever had a negative experience with sharing, or can think of someone else who's had a, like, what is a downfall or a possible negative to sharing?
Wow, that's a really good question. And I have. Not anything like personal attacks. And so I've been very fortunate there, where it's kind of like, I don't know, like, you know, sometimes I would hear third hand that people have said to them, well, Al Levine's just full of poop, you know, or something like that. But not like that. You know, I had like twice where I thought things were just like, my favorite thing to do is like parodies of things. And so I did something about an old sort of like, what was a popular approach to instructional technology. And I sort of did a believe it or not thing about learning objects. And actually, like, I got a letter, a cease and desist letter from the Ripley's people. Because to me, it was just like farcical, and it was kind of funny. But actually, the story site, the very first one, I called it Amazing Stories of Openness, because that's how it felt to me. And I kind of did my own Photoshop versions, remixes of covers from this old magazine called Amazing Stories, because there was like an archive of them on the internet I found. But then I actually got an email from the person who actually like is a family member or owns the right. And like people legally do this a lot. They can just say like, get a lawyer to send you something. I don't want to go to court to fight this. So I kind of changed the name like True Stories, because I found a public domain comic site called True Stories. But that's really minor on the level of like a negative thing that has happened. You know, boy, it's a really good question. I've had something that I've made that I thought was highly original, and I found that someone else, you know, did a derivative. But then, of course, I realized that I think I probably got it in my head from someone else. We can get trapped up into that idea about someone like took my idea, and people do it. I mean, actually it does happen. And so there is commonplace. There is a lot of theft of original ideas, and, you know, and it's different because if my livelihood depended upon these works, it would mean something. The person who influenced me a lot in understanding is a photographer who became professional photographer, Jonathan Wirth, who became an open educator, taught some open courses in photography, but sort of like he was like paid good money for doing portraits of celebrities and famous people. He has like a photo he took of the Dalai Lama in his office. He had taken a famous portrait of actor Heath Ledger not long before he passed away, one of the last ones. And Jonathan was adamant about chasing down on the internet illegal copies, as he saw it, of his work. And as he tells it with his great British accent and flurry about, he found it on this website, and he was like, he was like madly typing, like, "You're taking money out of the food out of the mouths of my children," and like, if, you know, "you have to stop this." And he got back this apologetic, like, "I'm so sorry" email from, it's like the biggest Heath Ledger fan site out there, and it's run by like a 12-year-old girl. Jonathan said, like, "What am I doing?" And so it was part of his sort of, and he frames it so much better, of understanding the difference between the creative art, the physical art, which is a real picture that he prints, and the digital representation of it, which you can't control the distribution. But still, it's hard to say when people's creative works do get stolen, and music does get literally stolen, and people who have shared photographs, they do get sometimes used by commercial firms against the creator's wish. And so the bad stuff happens.
I think putting a Creative Commons license on, for me, has helped me feel like someone can acknowledge that I'm sharing and that they're allowed to remix and play with it. I think, too, I've gotten more interested in NFTs and how that's going to affect digital pieces of work. And that photograph, for instance, if it had an NFT, like a tag on it, how that could kind of impact how it's shared. So I think there are ways that we're developing to track that, but I hope it doesn't deter from it. Like, I think Creative Commons is great because you still get acknowledgement. Yeah. And like you said, as long as it's not your bread and butter and you're able to feed your family or yourself. Cause that's another issue I have as someone who's just a student just getting in. I go like, "I don't have the money to do this, guys." Like, sharing is a bit of a privilege, but I think, yeah, it's a balancing act between, okay, I can make money off of this and I can be acknowledged for this, but I still want others to be able to be creative.
Yeah. And that's tough to accept because, you know, I'm a big fan of Creative Commons. I use it all the time, but I think people get lost in the idea that it protects their work, and it really doesn't. I mean, it gives you, if you find someone who violates your license, you can spend a lot of money and time and go to court and you can try to sue them, but it's not like anything that's enforceable. And so it's asking for the grace and generosity of someone out there. And so, you know, most people will abide by it, but there's a significant number that won't. And yeah, whether NFTs will really provide that, it could be. I'm not deeply, well, I don't understand it, first of all, but I'm not looking for the protection, because if you really want to protect your digital assets, don't put them on the internet. Like, just don't, like, put low res or just describe them. But you know, if you don't want it taken, you know, don't put it out there.
What's your definition of sharing versus collaborating? Could you separate? Is it possible to separate them?
There's some kind of Venn diagram there. Can I share without collaborating? Yeah, probably in a way, unless you unless you sort of you know, say that if I share something with you and you find it and make reuse of it and send me like, "Hey, you know, I used your X here," is that really collaboration? That's more like generosity acknowledgement. I guess sharing is sort of a thing that we do perhaps individually, and collaborating, of course, is the thing that we do with others. Although I would say I share to others, but like, I don't really say like, well, yeah, I could say like, "Nicole, look, I'm sharing this specifically with you." that's a little bit different from saying like, I'm sharing my creative works or my written works for the world at large. And so I sort of think like sharing is something that sort of like originates at least with us, leads to collaboration. Interesting question. I think it'd be good to flesh it out more and hear what other people say. Yeah, I don't think I can separate them. Interesting philosophical discussion. Can you collaborate without sharing? Or can you share without collaborating?
If you were talking to someone who was very new to open, because I'm hoping that some people that are just getting involved in this do listen to this, do you have any words of advice or encouragement on why someone should dip their toes in the water? Or,
well, they shouldn't do it because I say so or I think it's great. You know, when I taught my media classes, I used to like start out with this virtues of open licensing and why I thought it was a good idea. I think the students nodded along, but I don't think I really convinced them. And it was more along the lines of accepting it because I, as the teacher, was sort of like saying it's a good thing. I want people to sort of like get to experience, like I did in that very first story I described, some benefits of working from someone else's material. So I sort of started crafting some of my early media assignments so students would have to like build off of, you know, we would do like a shared, you know, what was then a Google Drive folder of media, and you'd have to, you know, create a remix with someone else's art and, you know, give them credit or something like that, or have them just exposed to places that provide really good art. Instead of this idea about you should look for open license stuff because you don't want to get in trouble for breaking copyright. And I think that's the way it's usually led, with this like sledgehammer of like, you don't want to get in trouble. Whereas if you sort of like get into this practice of not only like making use of other people's work, but acknowledging it and even going to the part of thanking them for it, because you might think they're a famous author or a famous painter. And chances are, like, these are people who wrestle with their own demons of inadequacy of their work. To know that someone found value in your work and took the time to message you, it doesn't hurt to thank people for the things that they've shared. And you get a connection. Like, all of a sudden, you've established a connection with that other person. They may not remember you. They may go home and like tell their family about it. Like, this is amazing. Like, this student named Nicole wants to use my photo to make a painting. And so this makes me proud. And so to me, that's just like another small potential for that, you know, creative connection or that possibility space where something good can happen that wouldn't be there if you just said like, oh no, I just write the attribution and I'm done. Or I just take the thing that's licensed public domain and don't even attribute it because I don't have to. I think you should attribute everything that you use, whether you have to or not.
For me, moving through the process of creating a press book and creating an OER, before in assignments when I would write, I would obviously use citations, but I didn't really think of where they were coming from. Like, I would include them because I had to. It was the rules. I didn't want to get in trouble and plagiarize. But after creating a book that was going to go out in the world and be accessed and read and remixed, I started to think, I need to look at it differently. And so, like, I quote and cite Cronin a lot in my chapter. And I got on Twitter and, like, I can put a face to the name and I can connect with her and ask her directly a question. And so it turned her into, she's a human. She is a person who's put a lot of work and effort into it. And until I hit that or that clicked.
She's an amazing person.
Big fan. I'm a fan girl.
Yeah.
But until I got to creating an OER and had the ability to connect with those researchers and, like you said, make those connections and network, I viewed it very differently. It was very rules-based, I have to cite, it's a university course, to like, now I very much respect these people's work and I want to include them in my own because they've influenced me and I can ask them questions and they've helped me learn. And so it's changed that enormously.
That's perfect, because like, yeah, if you're writing a paper and you put something in the bibliography, you know, Cronin, C, 2020, yeah, that's proper. But like, if you say, who is this person? You look them up, you see their Twitter bio, you follow the link to their blog, you see her pictures of the flaggy shore of Ireland where she walks. And then you sort of see who she talks to and the way she talks. And so that is so much richer than getting the APA formatting right.
Yes.
Which exactly. is what you just said.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that to me is understanding where that information and where those ideas and respecting where they come from and being grateful for them. I think you're right. It allows you to connect and it pushes you in a different way. And so open. And for me, I had to move through the process. Again, it was like, I couldn't just be told. I didn't have a professor come in and say, you need to do this, this, and this. It was give it a try, put it out in the open, see what happens with your work. And I think it's definitely changed how I move in the world.
So to turn the interview around, like how can students better understand this process than being like told it's the right way to do things? How can they get a lived experience like you did?
Yeah. So again, I think the design that Verena came up with, so the fact that we were producing as it was student co-created or co-designed is what the term they use, co-designed OER, that allowed me to move through that process. And it made sure that my assignment wasn't just a disposable, I put a lot of hours into it to check some boxes and get an A. It was scary and it was a lot more work and it took a lot more hours, but I learned a heck of a lot more because I had the opportunity to go through it. And then at the end, we weren't forced to share, but you'd kind of learn slowly through these different participatory activities what it meant to share. And so you were either comfortable or you weren't there yet, and that was fine, but you had that as an opportunity. And so I think the more you can get those type of projects into a course, you see it a lot more in K-12, to be totally honest, but I think it's just starting to trickle up to university. I think Dr. Roberts used a press book as a bit, I call the press book the gateway drug to OER, because the average person at the institution understands a textbook that makes sense to them. They didn't necessarily understand using Twitter or all these other.
Felix, get over here. Sorry, he made a lunge.
Felix, you saw him, you caught him. You had him in the corner of your eye. You're like, Felix is gone.
Well, yeah, that's, you know, the student contributed projects, often in press books or open publishing, are a fantastic experience. As are the projects where students get involved in understanding of contributing to public knowledge in Wikipedia. And so the Wikimedia Foundation, because it's kind of a different level of publishing, and it's a little bit more of an abstract environment to get a sense of as opposed to a textbook, but it's incredibly valuable. Probably you remember, like in middle school or high school, you were like discouraged from using Wikipedia because it was such a, you know, a sketchy environment. And, you know, and their instructors who still feel that way, but it's definitely gotten way more appreciation and understanding for what it enables. And it's absolutely OER to like a massive degree.
Yeah, it's a mind shift for me. I've been that teacher who's gone through and told my students, don't cite Wikipedia. Like, I've been that person completely. And so it is a mind shift. I think too, it's more sustainable than saying, okay, produce a press book. We're not there yet, I think, with press books. I know with the one that we created, the amount of copy editing that went in to it, just the demand on feedback from instructors. And they really wanted to do a peer review, an academic review of all the chapters. So from the time we finished to the time it actually came out was a year of back work that the students didn't necessarily see. And so that for every course is not, or for a large course, say you had 600 students, I can't see it, but Wikipedia, I think you're right. It's more abstract, but I think it's got more maybe levels of access to it. There's more ways of being easier. It's easier to get involved with.
And there's like, you know, it'd be a good thing to think about, to figure out with your peers is like, what are the other avenues for contribution to public knowledge that aren't as intensive as doing a press books? And so, and again, with Wikipedia, people think of the Pedia part, but Wikimedia Commons, it's easy and they make it easy to find things that need, you know, photos and illustrations added to it as a public good. And, you know, some of the science projects that ask people to become like, you know, contribute, you know, to you know, computing, you know, giant computing algorithms or, you know, so I think there's a lot more of those smaller scale things out there that people could get a sense of that reward of doing more than the disposable assignment and actually seeing where their work, you know, appears in the world. I mean, that's the key. Sorry, the cat. Felix is sleeping on the floor and the cat is just walking by taunting. Okay.
I understand why Felix doesn't like this cat.
Well, no, he wants to play. I think he doesn't understand, but she has like no fear. I mean, literally, she was this far from his butt, but he was sleeping.
So thank you for all of your support and help and advice, because we've definitely taken a lot of it.
Sure. Anytime.
I think Alan has posed a really good challenge and question to everyone out there. So if you're listening and you've got any really creative or awesome ideas as to how to involve your students in knowledge building and contributing in open environments, I'm all ears. I'd love to hear. Just to make it clear, no cats or Felixes were hurt in the production of this podcast. Both survived. They're still not friends.